For the last month or so, I've been meeting with a great group of young people who will be confirmed during the Easter service next Sunday. At every class session we had, I tried to ask them the following question. What is the defining story for the Jews in the Hebrew Scriptures? What would the Jews say is their most significant story in what we call the Old Testament? If you had asked me that question within the first 25 years of my life, I would have started thinking about the beginning of the Bible. I'd start with Genesis and try to think of all of the stories, weighing them out one by one. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. Then you have Noah and the flood that comes next, and then the Tower of Babel. And then we get to those great stories of Abraham and Sarah and their child Isaac and grandchild Jacob. And then there's the story of Joseph and that amazing Technicolor dream coat. I would have gone through all of those stories and still would have not gotten to the foundational story for the Hebrews, which is the story of Moses leading the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, leading them out of bondage into the wilderness and eventually into the promised land. This, of course, is also the story where the Ten Commandments are given to the Jews. The foundational story of Moses leading the Jews to freedom is also critical for understanding the important story we're focusing on today, Palm Sunday, Jesus entering Jerusalem. For you see, there were thousands and thousands of other Jews flocking to Jerusalem at this time of year because they were celebrating Passover. Passover is the celebration of the story I was just talking about, the Hebrew people's liberation from slavery, the Moses story. And the Jews don't just celebrate this story or remember it. They act it out. They tell the story and have a special meal and act it out to become one with the story. They don't just remember Moses and Aaron and what their many ancestors did. They become their ancestors. They become the ones who were doing what had been done to experience their freedom. Well, guess what? It needs to be done again. Because after the Jews gained their freedom and had many, many, many years of independence and their own government, the Roman Empire conquers them and they take over Jerusalem in 63 BC. No longer is there Jewish independence. The Jews are now under Roman rule. And so when Jesus enters Jerusalem around 32 AD, the Roman tax system was exploiting everyone except the political and religious elite, making the poor poorer and the rich richer. And this system was all legitimized by religion. Some of the high priests, some of the religious leaders were collaborating with the Romans, sometimes just so to keep the peace. Well, since Jerusalem was the center of this religious and political power in Palestine, it was the place where the forces of oppression came together. The forces that Jesus had been criticizing from way up north in the hills of Galilee. If there was going to be any national change, It needed to happen in Jerusalem. And so Jesus, who had been in ministry for 2 to 3 years north of Jerusalem, on the hillsides and in the small towns of Galilee, makes the journey south to Jerusalem. It's time to make a statement. So what we were doing today when we were reenacting Palm Sunday, when we made our march into the sanctuary with our palms, we were reenacting a political demonstration. We were saying we have had enough. We want to be free again. And what better time for this to happen than when we're remembering how Moses led the people out of captivity. In fact, we have a new Moses. His name is Jesus. He's related, in fact, to David, the wonderful king we had. Jesus will be a great king like David was. You see, the Sunday before there was a resurrection on Easter, there had been an insurrection. An insurrection precedes a resurrection. And when you think about that, that's a pretty good metaphorical phrase. An insurrection precedes a resurrection. Sometimes we need to leave the comfort and security of the place we know, our Galilees, and travel to the center of power, our Jerusalems, to seek the change we hope for and need. We have to go there to be face to face and to risk our future. Those who are reluctant to take risk never leave Galilee and will therefore never experience crucifixion or resurrection. They just stay at home and hope that someone else will make life better for them. But Christ continues to call us to join the procession. When we give up our need to get ahead, when we give up our need to be better than others or to advance on behalf of other people, we join Jesus' procession. When we let go of those places where we need to be right and others wrong, we ride alongside Jesus. When we soften inside and forgive, when we make a mistake and say, I'm sorry, when we take up the cause of the poor and the excluded, we join the procession into Jerusalem. It's a good metaphor. But let's go back to that actual first Palm Sunday. And again, it's important for us to see the relationship between the Moses Jews liberation story and the Palm Sunday story. Passover made the Romans very, very nervous. They had good reason to be nervous. Thousands and thousands of Jews are flocking from all over the world to Jerusalem because of Passover, which celebrates what? Their independence. You're like my confirmation class. I'm asking you again. They're celebrating their independence. But remember, they are no longer independent. They are now under Roman rule. And the Romans know that the Jews have independence on their minds and in their hearts. And they are about to burst. So when Jesus is parading into Jerusalem with a bunch of hopeful peasants, Pontius Pilate is parading into Jerusalem on the other side of the city with Roman reinforcements. There's a military parade going on the other side of town. Soldiers who are there to keep order. Soldiers to keep the Jews in line during this very volatile time. So you can see early on that there's going to be conflict. Something has to give, and it's not going to be the Romans. To make matters worse, After entering Jerusalem, Jesus goes to the temple and starts turning over the tables of the money changers who are cheating people. He runs them out. My Father's house should be a house of prayer, and you have made it into a den of thieves. You're robbing people. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. Didn't Jesus know better? You don't mess with people's money. You don't mess with people's power. You don't mix religion and politics. Didn't someone tell him that? Apparently not. Because they arrest him, strip him, beat him, and then nail him to a cross just outside the city wall so everyone can see what happens to anyone who mixes religion and politics. On a beautiful Saturday afternoon in 1968, when I was 9 years old, I was cutting the grass, mowing the lawn at my house on the corner of 65th Street and Abercorn, a house many of you pass by every week. I've cut that lawn 1,000 times. On this particular day, a really cool-looking, old-fashioned Model T Ford pulled up in front of our house. It had colorful flags and banners on it, promoting someone who was running for office. A tall man stepped out of the car and came over to me. "Are you Wendell Hester's son?" "Yes, sir," I said. "I knew your dad. In fact, we're related. We're cousins." I had never seen the man before in my life. "I wonder if you would do me a big, big favor. I'm the campaign manager for so-and-so." I can't remember his name. "Who's running for so-and-so." I don't remember which office. He said, "I will give you a whole dollar if you pass out all of these flyers for me." He had a big stack of them in his hand, pieces of cardboard paper that said, "Vote for so-and-so." A dollar for a 9-year-old boy in 1968 was a fair piece of change. I could buy 4 packs of baseball cards with a dollar. He handed me the flyers and started to give me the dollar, but before he let go of it, he said, "Now promise me you'll pass every single one of them out." "I promise," I said, "I'll do it." He hopped back into the fancy car and took off. I finished mowing the lawn and started on my journey of passing out the flyers. By the way, never do what I did. Never pass out campaign material about someone or something you don't know anything about. I didn't know better. I was 9 years old, and all I had on my mind was that dollar bill and that I was helping a relative. So I start going door to door, passing out the flyers. I went 2 blocks east, 2 blocks north, 2 blocks west, 2 blocks south of my house. I don't remember if it was because it was starting to get dark, or if I had gotten tired, or if I had gone as far from my home as a 9-year-old boy could go by himself, but I stopped. And I still had a stack of flyers left. I had run out of time and run out of houses. What was I to do? I had promised this man that I would pass every single one of these flyers out. I was stuck. And as I was feeling guilty about this, I had a brainstorm. A brilliant idea. The perfect solution. The very next morning, my mother, sister, and I got up early to go to Sunday school. When we get to the church, I don't go directly to my Sunday school class. I take a detour to the sanctuary. No one was inside. Everyone was in Sunday school. So I went row by row, pew by pew, placing a campaign flyer at every spot where someone would be sitting. I even went up to where the preacher preached and put one right on the pulpit. Can you imagine the look on that minister's face when he got up to preach and saw that on the Bible? Amazingly, I did not get lectured to or punished. I think it's because no one ever found out who did it. But I bet it was the main topic of conversation at the next church council meeting. Please, nobody do what I did. Because what I did was actually against the law. Some churches and congregations do it, unfortunately, but churches and nonprofits are not supposed to engage in political campaigning for people running for office. However, we can talk about issues. In fact, we should talk about issues, about what's right and what's wrong. One of the great prophetic voices in the 20th century was William Sloan Coffin. He was at the great Riverside Church where Judy and Jones met and later got married. In one Palm Sunday service there, he said, "Don't believe that Jesus was only a spiritual Messiah and not a political one. That's the great Palm Sunday cop-out that will be proclaimed from pulpits all over the land today. Had Jesus been as non-political as some of these pastors suggest, you can be sure the nails would have never grazed his hands." We're all familiar with the statement, the separation of church and state. That's a good thing. That's a really good thing. The separation of church and state is to protect religious freedom. It supports our religious liberty and diversity. That's very different from mixing religion and politics. Very different from what Palm Sunday was about. Religion shapes our moral conscience. Or at least it should. And politics helps us live out that conscience. My religion helps me to determine what I believe is right and wrong. And politics gives me the tool to express those beliefs. Be it by who or what I vote for, who or what issues I support, who or what I march for or what I march against. The problem is not that we shouldn't mix religion and politics. The problem is that we don't do it enough. That we don't work at it. That we don't take it seriously enough. That we don't do our homework on policies and politicians. But if you want to take your religion seriously, you need to take your politics seriously. They go hand in hand. This is God's world. Those who love God should try to do all we can do to take care of God's world and all of God's children, all of God's creation. The systemic way we're supposed to do that is called politics. City, state, nationally, globally, and religiously. There are politics and religion too, and I'm glad that our church stands up for justice, even if it means recognizing that our particular denomination is doing something wrong sometimes. Now, there are many other ways we can help the world, of course, and we should. But the only way we can systemically change the world is through politics. Remember, that's why Jesus had to go to Jerusalem. If he didn't believe that or do that, he would have just stayed in Galilee. Every time I take a confirmation class to Epworth by the Sea, our Methodist Center on St. Simon's Island, we tour the Methodist Museum. And I always make sure to show them a portrait, a beautiful portrait of a woman named Fanny Kemble. It's been said that Fanny Kemble is the most famous 19th century person that you've never heard of. Fanny Kemble was a great English actress. known to be one of the most beautiful women in the world in the 1800s. At the age of 20, she played Juliet in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet at the Covent Garden Theatre in London. She would go on to play all of the principal female roles at that time, especially in Shakespearean plays. While touring the United States, she was swept off her feet in Philadelphia by a man named Pierce Butler. And in 1834, Pierce and Fanny got married, settled down in Philadelphia, and had two children, two daughters. Fanny was an abolitionist. And when the couple married, Pierce was not a slaveholder, but his grandfather was, who was also named Pierce Butler. You probably know that name. He was one of the founding fathers, a member of the Continental Congress. He had huge plantations on St. Simon's Island. In fact, after Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton, he came down to one of those plantations to hide and to lay low. One of those plantations is where Epworth by the Sea now stands. When the elder Pierce Butler died, he left the plantations to his grandson, who made a fortune in cotton, tobacco, and rice, and who now had more slaves than anyone in the United States. Fanny lived in Philadelphia, but in the winter of 1838, she went down to St. Simon's for the first time, and what she saw appalled her. She was horrified at the conditions of the slaves and what they were experiencing. She kept a journal of her experience and wrote about what she had witnessed. "Knowing what I know and having seen what I have seen, I must do all that lies in my power to show the dangers and the evils of this frightful institution." She wanted to publish her journal so people could hear about the horrors of slavery. Of course, this did not go over well with hubby. In fact, he told her that if she published the journal, he not only would divorce her, he would keep the two children, because women had no rights about keeping children at that time. But that's what happened. In good conscience, she could not stay silent. Fanny published her journal. Pierce divorced her, and he kept both of the children. Fanny was not able to reunite full time with her daughters until they were 21 years old. Fanny's diary was circulated among abolitionists before the Civil War. And once the war broke out, the journal was published in England and in the United States. She went to the British Parliament to discourage England from supporting the South during the war, and indeed, England voted to be neutral. In the meantime, Pierce almost went bankrupt. He was a horrible businessman, and in order to pay his debts, he had to sell his slaves. The largest slave auction in the United States was held on March 3rd and March 4th, in 1859, do you know where it was? Right here in Savannah. Pierce had the slaves brought up from St. Simon's to Savannah. There used to be a big horse track in Savannah, one of the finest tracks in the country. It was off of Augusta Avenue, right by Bartow Elementary School. That's where the largest slave auction in the United States took place. 436 men, women, children, and infants who were sold, and many of them separated. It rained both days of the auction. It rained nonstop and became known as the weeping time. Thank God for like people like Fanny Kemble, who are willing to join the palm processional into Jerusalem, willing to do justice, even if it means they will be crucified. Well, the title of the sermon was Palms and Pedicures. And I'm afraid that I spent all my time this morning talking about the palms and nothing about pedicures. But it's really okay because the pedicures haven't happened yet. They occur on Thursday night, the night Jesus breaks bread with his disciples, and then he gets down on his knees and goes into the foot washing business. It wasn't just about removing their sandals and washing the dust and dirt from their feet. In Jesus' day, feet were really dirty. The streets were full of animal dung and human waste. Washing feet was work that was only fit for slaves. It was such a difficult task that the Roman law said that even Jewish slaves were not required to do it. For Jesus to insist on washing his disciples' feet was shocking. I don't think it was on his bucket list. My guess is that it was a spur-of-the-moment decision. He's trying to have an intimate dinner party, his last supper with his friends, when he talks about coming into his kingdom one day, and the disciples start squabbling over who will sit on his right hand, who is the most important. I wonder if they would have even had been arguing about who should be washing each other's feet, and Jesus just simply has enough. And he gets up, strips down, gets the washbowl, towel, and pitcher, and shows them what it's all about, what's really important. And in case they didn't get it, he says to them, enough with being important. Following him is about having the humility to wash feet. It's about loving and serving one another. And you know it worked. It got their attention. Foot washing became a regular feature of the early Christian community. I'm sure, like me, getting your feet washed can be a bit awkward. Some of us may feel embarrassed about our feet and they look how they look with our corns and such. But I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you to let Jesus put his hands on your feet. If you allow Jesus to touch your feet, perhaps you will also allow him to touch your will. We all have a mind, we all have emotions, and we all have a will, a decision-making power. Our feet are how we put our decisions in motion. Allow Jesus to clean your feet, to remove all that prevents you from using your feet to follow him. Allow him to scrub away your insecurities, to wash away your bitterness, to comfort and to massage your pain. May the water soothe and strengthen your faith and your courage as you seek to step out of your comfort zone of Galilee and follow Jesus into the risky, ambiguous world of politics and economics, of justice and loving others. Let us follow Jesus into the world he so passionately loves.